Welcome back to The Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. So are you among the many, many Americans experiencing an intense search or a hunger for transformation, spiritual transformation? The good news is you're not alone, especially in Los Angeles. Joining me are the authors of a book called Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life. Marilyn Schlitz, Cassie Veaton, and Tina Amarok, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
I've got three women. Now we've got four women on the phone. So I have a question. I'm going to start with you, Marilyn. We talk about transformation a lot on The Aware Show. This is, my life. I live and breathe this. Don't always get it right, but I'm always living and breathing it. But are we preaching to the choir? Do we live in a bit of a bubble here in the spiritual community in the West?
Well, I think if you are, like everybody else who's tracking what's happening in this election year, what we're hearing about is change, change, change. And so I think that the notion that we are living in a time of enormous complexity, that all of us are trying to figure out how to navigate our way amidst competing messages and overstimulation, and that we are really hungry, I think, for something different than the world that is lacking in meaning and purpose for us. So I would say that there are a group of people who are already familiar with this language and a vast population of people who are hungry for more information about how to navigate change and transformation.
But, aren't we hearing the same political promises that we've heard before? I mean, the issues are different, and yes, it is different, but where's the, I don't really hear anything about blending science and religion on, the political candidate route. I mean, is that something that Americans are interested in?
Well, I think that the surveys that we get through something like the Gallup poll, for example, suggest that people are hungry for greater meaning, that they are looking for spirituality as opposed to religion. And that religion also is something that people are trying to discriminate their way through. What is unusual about the times we're living in is a couple of things. One, that we have these two huge truth systems or worldviews, one represented by science, as you say, and one represented by religion/spirituality. And these are converging now in ways that, have been treated on the front page of, the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report last week had a very interesting cover article around all of this. So I think that the mainstream is interested. And so at the same time as you have these two dominant systems of knowing, in a way, coming together, you also have an enormous complex mix of different worldviews and traditions. So all the different cultures that we find coexisting today in a common grocery store, in the public school system, or in the hospitals. You have a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Jew, a pagan, an atheist, a devout Christian, all sharing the same resources. And so it becomes not only an opportunity, but really a requirement that we can come up with some ways to navigate through all these differences to find a respectful meeting place in between.
Well, I want to ask you, Cassie, about Cassie's a psychologist. And I've noticed that, the Catholic Church is going through its growth stages and people are migrating more towards the middle of what is spirituality and what is this concept and so forth. What do you think about a society of people that are growing away from organized religion, more towards spirituality, doesn't really have an organized type of perspective? What do you think about a society or a generation of kids growing up with those types of concepts or lack of organized religion?
Well, on one hand, first of all, I think what you're saying is very true, and it's borne out by, as Marilyn mentioned, a recent Gallup poll. One of the findings was that about 72% of Americans are saying that they feel that their spirituality is more personal than organized, and so they identify more with a personal sense of spirituality than they do with their organized religion. Not to say that they don't consider themselves a Christian or a Jewish person, but they're much more interested in how they are personally interpreting and relating to that.
Yeah, it's great. They're asking more questions.
Yeah, and I think it's a very exciting time. I mean, it's really only in the last, 100 years, on the furthest end, and maybe even 50 years, that people have had the opportunity to choose their own spiritual path. Prior to that, you were just born into your spirituality. You were born into being what you were going to be for the rest of your life. And back then, conversion was a big, radical move. You know, you used to hear a lot about, you know, he converted to Judaism. Like, it was a big, big thing. And now people are being given a personal right to choose their spiritual path and to combine different traditions into something that they have a unique affinity for. And so I think on one hand, very exciting, makes the spirituality much more personal. You can work with your own affinities and what you truly believe. And on the other hand, there are some ways that organized religions are very, very beautiful and in a way deeply
traditional, and they hold a lot of meaning.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I bet you a lot of that one. I'm just kidding. Tina, are you, you're also coming from this background as well as being a clinical psychologist and doing more of the recovery of being, I understand, and trauma. How do you think that what I was just talking about in terms of the trend a little bit away from organized religion, however, there are still a lot of people still into traditional religion, which is absolutely wonderful, but how do you think that has to do with trauma and recovery and so forth?
I think one of the things that we were doing in this research, one of the promises of research like this is to complete the translation process from more esoteric ideas and concepts and language to a more common everyday language. And this is true also in situations such as healing and trauma and recovery. That is to say that what this research looks at are experiences that are common amongst all people and across traditions that in our culture we've thought of as esoteric and reserved for religious dogma or conversations or esoteric spirituality or ivory tower kind of academia. And what we have discovered in the research is that what we're talking about, be it transformation or we want to distinguish between when traumatic situations can become transformative, but just sticking to transformation, that this is very innate and natural to who we are as human beings, and we wanted to help complete that translation process to affirm and validate people's experiences so that it becomes more a part of our everyday lives.
Okay, so Marilyn, let me come back to you here. What do you define as transformation? We'll just back up a little bit here. And what is it? What is transformation? And can you share with us some of the studies that you guys have found, some of the science behind it?
Well, we at the Institute of Noetic Sciences were founded 35 years ago by Edgar Mitchell, one of the Apollo 14 astronauts. And Edgar basically had an epiphany or a transformational experience on his way back from the moon. As he looked at planet Earth suspended in the vastness of space, he had this epiphany that instead of thinking about planet Earth as divided based on class or ethnicity or race or, politics, that what he saw was a whole system. And his experience came from his inner authority, his sense of a direct experience. And as a scientist, he was interested in changing the conversation so that instead of our focus on outer space and that exploration of the world outside of ourselves, what would happen if we brought the same resources and the same rigor and discernment that science represents to the study of our inner experience and to really understanding better where the root of these problems come from in the first place, there's nothing inherent in planet Earth that says we have to have conflicts over tribalism, for example. That's something about our consciousness and the worldview we hold. So the Institute of Noetic Science was actually founded out of this notion of a transformation from a worldview that separates ourselves from the world in which we're embedded to one in which we see our fundamental interconnection and relationship. About 10 years ago, I was visited by a very successful businessman, not anybody you would associate with mysticism or New Age or any of this kind of speaking to the choir comment. And he had had one of these transformative experiences where he recognized that as he looked out over the Pacific Ocean, he got a profound connection to his unity, the unity that comes in all of life and all of nature. And he felt that this experience had so profoundly affected his life and really made him a better person that he wanted to see if other people had had this kind of experience. So we really started in a search to try and understand what is transformation, who has it, how do you stimulate it, how do you sustain it, and what are the outcomes for people. And so the first thing we did was actually solicit people to write to us their stories of transformation, what kind of experiences had they had, and what were the circumstances under which they'd had it. And we got hundreds of responses from people telling us about their own transformations. So this helped to answer the first question, which is Dick Gunther wasn't alone. Many people had reported mm-hmm. these things.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step was to convene a group of thought leaders, and we conducted three focus groups with these thought leaders to try and understand exactly what is transformation and how do you begin to facilitate it.
Was there a through line throughout those three different leaders?
Well, the through line for them really was there were a couple of things. One is when the people described their personal stories, it was like a hero's journey. And most of the people who wrote us these stories talked about their life before and after. So there was some fundamental change in the way they perceived their own personal identity. And it went from the sense of I, my own ego navigating in a world that's sort of foreign from myself, to a sense of we, and so my individual identity being much more relational and connected. We then did, and the basis of the book, Living Deeply, is really interviews, in-depth interviews with 60 masters from different world traditions, looking for that common thread, as you say, through these different traditions, respecting and appreciating all of the ways in which they're different, but finding a tremendous amount of overlap in the ways in which they were similar about this idea of transformation. And then finally, we conducted a survey of 1,000 people to begin to calibrate what we'd learned from these teachers and to translate it into the everyday person. And through all of that, we have seen that there are things that can be done to facilitate this kind of transformation. There are things like, you know, curiosity and openness. There are qualities of what we're talking about as transformation. And in particular, we tend to think about this shift in perspective. So it's not so much that anything fundamental is changing about, you know, our biology or even our families or our business or our work life, but what changes is our perception. So rather than seeing something as an annoyance or something as a great burden or we're victims of our circumstance.
Or something out there or away from or ahead of us.
Exactly.
Right.
It's a shift in perspective such that we recognize the opportunity in any moment to allow us to have a broader understanding of who we are and what we're capable of becoming.
Like Edgar Mitchell did when I actually had the wonderful opportunity of interviewing him. He gave me this great account of his story of from space looking down at planet Earth as just a teeny weeny little speck in this greater whole, which is our universe, and it gave him a totally different perspective. And as you talk about getting off of the ego and so forth, and his life's journey has been to communicate that message and to share that experience with people. So when what you found, this is very, very inspiring, by the way, that you found that more and more people are interested in incorporating some type of practice of transformation into their work life or their day life or something that's practical in their lives. So does that mean, in your opinion, that we're going to take this conversation out of the bubble and move it more into, I mean, is there a future for transformational conversation?
Well, if you're still on me,
I would say yes.
Absolutely. What we're seeing is that there's a hunger for a greater appreciation for the qualities that make us human. So one of the things we're very excited about that's coming out of the book and out of our decade of research is what we're calling worldview literacy, and really taking the findings and the principles that we have distilled from this research into the public school system and creating a curriculum that will really help students to embrace the complex nature of what the world is like as they're growing up into it, but really giving them a tangible set of skills and tools that will allow them to appreciate all the differences that coexist in reality. And in that sense, giving them a different frame of perception that will allow them to be happier and healthier amidst all the complexities.
Oh, and that's what's going to help. Rather than taking art and music out of schools, let's put yoga into schools and,
exactly.
and put that into the curriculum. Those mm-hmm. are the types of things that I want to see on the initiatives. So, I mean, in your opinion, also, Cassie and Tina, feel free to share your perspective on that. What were some of the other things that you noticed that came out of some of the things that people could do on a practical level?
Well, this is Cassie. I'll just jump in and say that I think part of what we're talking about here is almost a democratization of spiritual practice so that people can have immediate access to practices in their everyday life without having to travel to the mountaintop or spend time in the Zendo, or it's just not feasible or even of interest to some people. And so one of the things we found about spiritual practices is that they can be formal practices, which, you know, are really nice because they do have these long roots and some established guidance. But many, many, many people perform informal practices that they find extremely useful in supporting their transformation. And what we found was that almost anything can be a practice if you bring four elements to it. The first element is the intention toward increasing your own well-being and the well-being of people around you and the planet, so a positive intention toward growth and transformation. A second is some way of training your attention so that you're paying attention in a different way on purpose to what it is that you're doing. Another element is guidance, having some form of some guidance from a teacher, which can be an external teacher, or it can be your own internal guidance, your own internal authority. And the last is repetition, doing it over and over and over again. And in that way, tending to your rose garden, or cooking meals for friends, or taking walks, or playing sports even, can become a transformative practice when those four elements are present.
Well, that's great. That's very, very practical. And so some of the stories in your book are how people were stepping up to doing that. Is there any one that stands out in your mind, Marilyn or Tina? You can feel free to answer this, or Cassie. It's a kind of a trick question, isn't it?
Tina, do you want to take a go at that? Were you asking, is there any one particular practice that comes to mind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Practice or story. Mm-hmm.
Well, in terms of formal practice, one of the practices that many of the teachers thought was most important, even if we were bringing this greater and greater awareness to our everyday lives so that everything we did could be a practice, as Cassie just described. But in terms of formal practice, that was meditation. And again, if we de-esoterize what meditation can be, it can be many things and many different things to different people. But essentially having time every day for solitude and silence.
I meditate sometimes while I'm running or on my bike, honestly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I get into a zone and my body takes care of itself and does its repetitive motion, and I go into a totally different place.
It can be a sitting meditation, mm-hmm. a walking, a running, mm-hmm. a cooking.
A biking. Right, a
cooking.
Biking.
Yeah. Sending your roses. We found people who talked about the garden as the temple mm-hmm. for them.
Right. No, that's great. That's terrific. So there's different ways of incorporating that into your life, and this is how transformation occurs. Paying attention to what you're doing, I really like that concept, because it's not only keeping your eye on the ball or whatever it is that you want to create, which of course has to do with the whole law of attraction, but it also, there are so many distractions that could, not only physical distractions like the internet and whatnot, but negative distractions like negative thinking and old patterns and reminders of you know, certain negative situations that get us out of the way of keeping our intention and our attention on what it is that we want rather than what we don't want, that can play a big role in this.
One of the things we're seeing is that simple things like your carpool, if you carpool in the morning, you know, creating a sangha or a kind of transformational community that that encourages growth and opportunity out of that carpool, or recognizing that you choose to be reactive to a certain conflict in your work life, for example. Whereas if you can reframe it and you can begin to change your perception and attend to it in a different way, that begins to create an opening for you rather than, you know, seeing yourself as a victim of the circumstance. You really become an empowered agent to affect change in a much more proactive way, you know, within your own reactivity.
Mm-hmm. And this is Cassie. I'll just add to that by saying, you know, making your carpool a sangha isn't necessarily saying, hey, can we all chant on the way to work? A practice can be something as simple as a deep inquiry, for example. And I want to mention the DVD that accompanies the book, Living Deeply. The DVD is a collection of 9 practices from some of the teachers that we interviewed who are providing about a 10 or 12-minute practice from a variety of the world's traditions, and one of those is from Angela Sarian, and it's a process of inquiry. So going back to the carpool, it could be something as simple as just saying to your carpool mates, what inspired you this week? And just have everyone answer that question. And so I think there's a real...
That sounds like a great DVD. I have not seen that. And does it relate it to practical use like that, like the carpool and so forth?
I think each of the practices that are presented in the context of their tradition, but they are all things that can be done immediately in your living room or maybe with a group that you decide to get together for 9 weeks to do each of the practices, or with an organization. So they're easily, I think, accessible and implementable into everyday life.
I mean, that does make a lot of sense. And one of the things I liked about your book is it said practice is a portal to the sacred. Mm-hmm. It's like a little flashlight into the world beyond in terms of how you can transform, what transformation is. Practice, 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 practice. It's always a very important thing to do if you're going to actually really affect behavior and affect subconscious behavior as well.
One of the things that we are really excited about is giving this book and the DVD legs. And so we really encourage people to visit the livingdeeply.org website. And on that are a number of ways in which you can begin to, you know, take this into your life. You know, beyond reading a book, how do you begin to live it? We also have an e-learning course that's there under the education button on the website that allows people to experience the book in a different form. And ultimately, there's a chat room and a forum for community building. So as people are exploring these ideas, one of the other outcomes of our research was that having a supportive, nurturing community as you're exploring things that aren't necessarily always supported by the dominant culture can be extremely helpful. Even these masters that we interviewed from these different traditions talked about how they need help to remember. You know, it's often Brother David Stendelrath talked about how he had come back from Africa, and while he was in Africa, he was so appreciative of having a drink of water. And he came home, and he was in his house, and every time he took a sip of water, he did it with gratefulness and real mindfulness, until about 3 days later when suddenly he found himself just drinking water without being mindful.
Right.
And so he took little stickums and put them all over his house as reminders to stop long enough to feel grateful for those little things that we take for granted.
That makes sense. And I like the fact that you take, sometimes these conversations of spirituality can get very higher or almighty, or not. I'm not absolutely not saying that IONS does that ever, but in certain circles it can be all about this very enlightened conversation. And I like the fact that you bring this to a practical level, because ultimately when you do stand in front of the sink or you do something like brush your teeth or something that you do as a habit, as a pattern, that's where you want to infuse this information. It's not, as you said, on the mountaintop or at the pulpit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sharon Salzberg was one of the teachers we interviewed, and she said to us that the classical understanding of spiritual life is exactly that. It is about the way we live our everyday lives, the way we talk to each other, relate to our children and our significant others, the way how truthful we are, everything that we do. And you mentioned the word sacred, and that's definitely one of the themes that keeps emerging in this research, really cultivating an eye for the sacred.
Okay.
Over and over, they talked about, you know, the shift in perception, exactly, to perceive the underlying sacredness of all things how that connects us.
That it's there everywhere. Well, thank you very much. The name of the book is called Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life. The website again for the book, Marilyn?
LivingDeeply.org.
Very easy. Thank you so much, Marilyn Schlitt.
Thank you.
Cassie Veaton.
Thank you.
And thanks, Tina. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your show.
Thank you. And that's it for me today. While I'm committed to bringing you the clearest information possible, in the end, I always encourage you to listen to your own truth in everything you do. Until next time, I invite you to stay aware.